This episode of This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Axia Audio, makers of the popular Element console with 2,000 now in the field, the Power Station, and the new IQ, now shipping. Check them on the web at axiaaudio.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt. It's a sight to see when you turn it on and all the tubes start glowing behind that glass. And you hear the, you know, hear the programming through the coils and things. It's pretty neat.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Dad? Yeah, all your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
It's not easy being green, said Kermit. But Chris Tarr and Chris Tobin are here to say otherwise. We got a great show for you.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. Hi there, I'm Kirk Harnack, and you've tuned in, downloaded, stumbled upon a program about radio engineering technology. And, you know, in radio, that can cover all kinds of things from microphones to, turntable styli. Yeah, we still have those. CD players, automation systems, and then all kinds of other things like mixing consoles and distribution amplifiers and digital distribution, audio processing, and then ways to get things to the transmitter site. And then even technology for doing like live remote broadcasts from various venues, sporting events. That's a huge one. Live talk shows from various places. And even, bar remotes, everybody's favorite Friday evening event at a radio station, typically rock and roll stations. So, whether it's from the club, whether it's from the studio, or whether it's from right here on the Twit Network, we're here to talk about radio and audio technology. I'm the guy who started the show because I begged and pleaded Leo to let us do it. He said, sure, yes, that's like a great idea. We have a couple of co-hosts on the show tonight, today, whenever you're listening, and co-host numero uno is Thomas Ray III. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Kirk. And, my wife says I should carry a club. Never mind, go to a club. But anyway, seeing as it's show 76, I'm going to introduce myself and go get my trombone. I'm Vice President of Engineering of Buckley Broadcasting out of WOR Radio in New York. And I'm up here in the Hudson Valley, which is about 50 miles north of New York City and about 15 miles west of West Point, where they have a lot of great concerts in the summertime.
Tom, one reason I asked you to be a co-host on the show back 76 episodes ago was because A, you're knowledgeable. B, you're a fun guy, right? You've always got a positive outlook on stuff. You're rarely negative. You're not afraid to voice your opinion. And what's also interesting about you is, you're not always right, but Tom, you're never in doubt.
That's true. You know where I stand, and I stand on my two feet right here. Anyway.
Well, I appreciate your contributions to the show, and you're going to have some things to contribute on this show. Let's go to the other co-host here on this show, and that is Christopher Tarr from Mukwonago, Wisconsin. Hi, buddy.
There you go. I am the director of engineering for Intercom's radio stations in Madison and Milwaukee, Wisconsin. That is 5 FMs and 1 AM. I'm a wrench, basically. I do that kind of work, handle the IT and technology side, as well as help out some other radio stations through the state, and keep myself busy doing that.
Hey, Chris, at the end of the show, let's make sure we mention your Geek Jedi website and forums. We're going to make sure that folks know about that, because that's some worthwhile things going on there. I know you do work hard occasionally on that website. Sure. I want to get into something really interesting from Radio World magazine. I love Radio World. It's nothing against the other magazines that are out there. There's Radio Magazine. There's Radio Guide, which also I find great articles in. But this edition of Radio World that I have here in my hot little hands, I wasn't able to find this particular article online yet. Maybe it'll be online in the next few days. But the headline of this article, this is from the March 23rd edition of Radio World. It's the NAB Show Preview Guide. And there's an article in here by Tom Vernon. Tom's been a writer with Radio World for quite a while, and he writes the headline, Alaska Test Cuts the AM Power Costs. Okay, that's, I always have trouble with headlines. But the whole idea is here is getting some green technology. And honestly, I didn't think this was really possible I mean, I kind of understand the laws of physics here, and I hadn't thought of any ways to cut power costs at radio stations, but this may be one way to do it. This is with AM transmitters. So this article, and we're going to provide a link here in the show notes, and I'm going to pass it along to Burke. Maybe you can get something on from a PowerPoint. I don't know if you can or not. I was using OpenOffice to open it up on my Mac. But there's a PowerPoint online where the folks at Nautel describe just how they how they're able to effect some power savings from AM transmitters. And the way they do this, give me one second here. I'm going to copy and paste this back into our private chat area. So, Burke, if there's any way that you have to bring that, I don't know if you got a way to bring a PowerPoint up online or not. There's a couple of graphs on there that are worth pointing out and some bullet points as well. The guys at Nautel have, not that they figured this out, they're implementing this. There's some technologies that were figured out by some folks at the BBC that's called dynamic amplitude modulation. Dynamic amplitude modulation was developed by AEG Telefunken. And then there's another method here called, amplitude modulation companding. And these are being tried out in Alaska. Chuck Lakatus, who's director of engineering for Alaska Public Broadcasting, he was seeing his energy bills for his half dozen 10 kilowatt AM transmitters really jump as the cost of power went up to 50 cents per kilowatt hour. And he knew that he had to try to do something. So he heard about these technologies, which are not yet legal for U.S. broadcasters. The FCC does not allow this technology to occur except with a special license, which apparently they obtained at Chuck Lakatus' public stations in Alaska. And it looks, just a quick read of this article, looks to me like they actually are using a couple of different technologies. One of the technologies for this, whenever the amplitude modulation is high, okay, so there's a lot of sidebands and there's a lot of audio going on. The AM carrier gets reduced. And this would normally increase the signal to noise ratio. I'm sorry, decrease the signal to noise ratio, make it more noisy. But they figure that the added power in the sidebands is covering up that noise anyway. So the idea is normally with an AM radio station, the carrier power stays constant and then the sidebands are added to the carrier power as modulation takes place. But the idea here is when there's power in the sidebands, let's reduce the carrier because we don't need it so much to make the radio noise free. And there may be other reasons that my cohorts and colleagues will mention to me. It sounds to me like the other method, though, is doing the opposite. It's whenever the modulation is low, the carrier also gets lower. And when the modulation is high, the carrier gets higher. So I may be misinterpreting this, and I'd like to read about and understand it further. I haven't done all my homework. There's in this PowerPoint that I'll provide some show notes to. The folks at Nautel describe this AMC, this automatic modulation control, amplitude modulation companding, excuse me, in which the carrier is very well. The bottom line is this. Bottom line is this. That a good deal of energy savings is possible. About a 30% power reduction, and Chuck Lakatus is reporting he was getting as much as a 39% power reduction. And if you're paying close to 50 cents a kilowatt hour, well, that can add up to a lot of money. Probably on the order of on a single transmitter could add up to $20,000-$30,000 per year. In electrical savings or in cost savings because you're saving that electricity. So let me bring in Tom and Chris. You guys ever heard of this? And does it sound like something that could be effective?
You know, I got I got Radio World the other day, Kirk. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but from what you described, that sounds interesting. And it would be interesting to try because, you know, if you're reducing the carrier where the modulation is low and let's say you have a talk format, you know, where you're going to have spaces. The radio kind of, the way it works, it kind of needs the carrier to kind of grab the signal, especially if you're on a seek function. So this is interesting. It's a very interesting concept. I've got to read the article. I really
do. A couple of notes from the Nautel presentation. The technology is most relevant to higher power stations. Now, Chuck Lucatus has some 10 kilowatt AM transmitters. Dautel uses the example of a 50 kilowatt AM transmitters. But if you're running a kilowatt AM transmitter and you end up saving a few percent of your power, it says, you know, used to have an AM transmitter in Cleveland, Mississippi, and I think the total electric bill was under $200 a month. So it just really wasn't that much. State-of-the-art AM transmitters are about 90% efficient anyway from AC in to RF out. But we're talking about here not necessarily more efficiency, but actually transmitting less power during certain individual moments in time. Let's see, the average power consumption for a 50-kilowatt transmitter, perhaps about 73 kilowatts. That's with 70% average modulation. That's a total of, on the air full-time, almost 9,000 hours per year. Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
It almost seems to me, from what you're describing and from the quick glimpses that I have, is that the companioning technology actually, to kind of answer Tom's question, it looks like during the silent passages, you've got full carrier power. It's when there's modulation going on that I might be wrong about this, that maybe the carrier power goes down at the expense of the sidebands. Maybe that's what they're talking about. It seems like maybe there's some kind of trade-off going on there in and out as the modulation changes.
So here's a bit of a summary from the folks at Nautel who have presented this paper. Carrier control algorithms were developed and tested back in the 1980s, and they are deployed in various places around the world. It's just haven't been in the U.S. Yet. The systems are a specified requirement in many transmitter bids. So Nautel and other companies, I'm sure Harris, perhaps Continental as well, when they receive a bid from a government, for example, not U.S., but other place around the country, this is a specified requirement in most high-power AM transmitter bids. So the research in the 80s revealed that significant reductions in transmitted and consumed electric power are possible with very minor impairments in subjective quality measurements on the received signal. So there is a little bit of downside. I'm guessing that this could increase the receiver's distortion a little bit as the carrier is moving up and down. But with modern transmitters, the cost of implementing this is very small or no cost in the case of brand new systems. However, the electrical energy savings are very significant, especially on high-power transmitters. The savings are complementary to the savings from modern high-efficiency transmitters. So there are some good block diagrams here. Again, we'll put this in the show notes. Those of you who are interested in this dynamic carrier control, it can be pretty cool here. And there's I need to understand this better. I'd like to myself. I just bring it up here because, hey, it surprised me. I didn't think, you know, green was something that applied so much to broadcasters, and kind of poo-pooed the idea of having, you know, green equipment in your studios and a green transmitter. But hey, if you can save, Chuck Lucatus says he's saving 39% power at one of his sites. Well, that can be pretty significant. It's over a third and almost half, if you want to look at it that way, power savings.
With power nowadays, Kirk, that's significant. I mean, knowing what we pay for power at the WR transmitter site every month, I mean, saving 39%, heck, that's several thousand dollars.
Yep.
Yeah, that goes right to the bottom line.
I think we should just all go to Vox-operated AM transmitters. Just, you know, transmitter shuts off when you're not talking, comes back on when you start talking.
Do hams do that?
Hams do that, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. And we also use single sideband, so we don't even use a carrier when we're doing AM most of the time. We can also do regular AM, but...
Well, wouldn't that be wild? Having consumers have to tune in that duck squawking until they get the station just right.
That'd be fun. Detail. Well, you know, in some cases with iBoc, it sounds like that when you're trying to tune it in. So I might get used to it.
I'm not sure that would work out so well. All right. Let's think about this, though. I was saying that I wouldn't think of too many ways to be green. You know what's really green is HD radio.
Kermit the Frog is really green, but anyway, yeah.
Now, you know, with these combining techniques that we have had to use in the first implementations of of HD radio for FM, they've been pretty inefficient. I mean, you end up throwing a lot of heat out the door. But if there's a day that we ever go to complete digital transmission for FM or whatever the technology is, we're transmitting HD radio signals at a whole lot less power than you know the main FM signal that's right next to it or that's in the middle of it. Isn't that right? Don't we use something like 20 dB down?
Anywhere between 1% and 10% is the total.
Yeah. Right. Well, and they've just recently approved the higher levels, but it started out being 1% of the power of the main carrier, right?
Correct. Yep. So, yeah, it was 1%, and now you can use up to 10%, depending on your frequency and what stations are around you and what your spacing is. So
anyway, bottom line, you could use a whole lot less power. Let's see. There's a radio station not far from me. It's an overheight Class A FM station, which means their effective radiated power. I'm not sure if they're a 6 or a 3 kilowatt Class A FM, but the bottom line is their ERP coming out of the antenna is 750. No, their TPO out of the transmitter 750 watts, and so they're not HD yet, but when they go HD, they'll get to put out a whopping 7.5 watts. Now, if they go with the minus 10 dB on the carrier, they can put out 75 watts. But what I'm saying is that they have a reasonably equivalent coverage area with at least with the 75 watts, and some argue, with the 7.5 watts. So bottom line, yeah, digital, HD, that's pretty green, isn't it? If you get a similar coverage area with 1/10 to 1/100 the power. All right, well, Kirk's turning over a new leaf on green. I kind of like this idea.
Well, there is some of that. It's not quite that simple, the math with HD, but it's close. But I do hear, especially with AM transmitters nowadays, with the as you were mentioning before, solid state transmitters, the AC to RF efficiency is phenomenal with them. FM unfortunately took kind of a step back when it went from tube to solid state. Solid state transmitters for FM aren't as efficient as the tube types were. On the order of probably 10 or 20% efficiency loss there. But if you want to talk about being green at transmitter sites, there's so many things we can do now that could affect that. Things like the LED lighting for towers. Things like you really need your modulation monitor plugged in if you're not there to look at it. Do you need distortion monitors plugged in when you're not there to look at them? Do you need there are a lot of those types of things. You walk into a transmitter site, often there's old gear plugged in that's not being used anymore, old processors that you're not using. There's still power applied to them, but nothing runs through them. Going through and taking a look at those sorts of things can have a significant impact depending on the situation. And that's stuff that outside of the tower lighting, that's pretty inexpensive to implement. But, tower lighting is huge. I have a 5-tower array in my backyard. Was at the time with incandescent, same amount of light bulbs, but, we're talking altogether 20 beacon bulbs and 20 side marker lights. Now imagine that with the 600-watt, two 600-watt light bulbs and one beacon, the kind of power consumption we're talking about there. And we cut that to about a tenth when we replace those with LEDs.
Wow. Wow. I realize we spent a fair amount of time here talking about AM, and I'm going to get back to that in just a second because there's a lot of folks that aren't aware of how healthy AM actually is in the U.S., at least financially, so still not doing bad in some markets. But this efficiency thing, Chris, I think we ought to spend a second explaining that. AM transmitters can be very efficient from AC input to RF output. Why are FM transmitters not nearly so efficient? More like on the order of 55, 60, 65% from AC and RF out.
That's a good question that I'm not sure I know the answer to. Well, I know some of the theory behind it, but it's the efficient. I have to believe it's, if I remember correctly, it's the, it might be the linearity of the amplifier, if I'm not mistaken.
And my understanding is it's just the efficiency of the solid state amplifying devices at that frequency. AM is so close to DC, it's pretty easy. But there's been advances in circuit design and power MOSFETs too. But with FM, you're talking about around 100 megahertz, and there's a lot more that's a lot faster turnaround time, you know, in the amplifier. And I'm sure I'm not using the right words, but at the higher and higher and higher you go in frequency, it may be a rule, it may be just where it works out this way, but you get less and less and less efficiency. You try to make a transmitter that transmits at 1 gigahertz with solid state devices, and it's fairly inefficient. I mean, think about how hot the back of your 950 megahertz STL transmitter gets. You know, from a couple of transistors that are amplifying that 950 megahertz signal, you're throwing off a lot of heat to get 8 watts or 10 watts out of that that transmitter.
I can tell you that a normal kind of tube FM tube rig will get you normally somewhere in the neighborhood of 79% efficiency. Current solid state transmitters are somewhere in the neighborhood of 60% efficient, if I'm my memory serves me correctly. So there's a big difference there, and I think you're right. I think it has to do with the power amplifiers, the solid state power amplifiers, the power transistors, and the efficiency with those.
Yep. So now let's get back to this this notion. We always hear it in the tech room. Hey, we're on the Twit TV network, which is very non-traditional. It's new media, right? So glad to be here and glad it's working this way. You can't count AM radio out yet. It's still there. This report just came out. I'm looking at the Radio Inc. Website, radioinc.com. The top billing radio station in America at over $57 million last year was an AM station in Washington, D.C., owned by Bonneville, WTOP. That's an AM station, $57 million. The next one was Kiss FM in Los Angeles. Okay, great. At $43 million. That's $12 million, but no, $14 million behind WTOP. Then the next one in line, WCBS News in New York at $49 million. I don't know why. Let's see. KFI in Los Angeles. So let's see. Is $46 million. Three out of the top four top billing radio stations in America are AMs. I'm sorry, WTOP has an FM as well. Okay. How about two out of four?
Well, you know, in Milwaukee, the highest rated radio station in Milwaukee is an FM or an AM station, rather, and that's the case in a lot of markets.
And I'm just using billing as a proxy for success and popularity. Obviously, if you're selling ads, people are, you know, business owners are shelling out their hard earned money to buy an ad on what they believe is something that's going to hit a lot of people. And you know, people don't spend money on stuff that doesn't work, at least not for very long.
So. Yeah, no. You know, the only downside with AM is keeping them on the air sometimes.
Yes, I swear it is tougher to keep AMs on the air sometimes. I swear than it is FMs. Well, I want to revisit this power thing, and maybe we'll get Chuck Kelly or from Nautel, or even better, maybe we'll get Chuck Lakatus from Alaska Public Broadcasting on the show, because I think this is really interesting. Saving, you know, about almost 40% on your power bill for a big AM transmitter. That's a ton. And, you know, in other places in the world besides America, there are plenty of really high-powered AM stations still on the air. I've been to sites that were putting out 100 kilowatts and 200 kilowatts, like in the country of Colombia and other Latin American countries. And in Mexico, too, there's stations pumping out that kind of power. What if they could save? Imagine saving 40, on a 100-kilowatt station, saving 40,000 watts every moment of every day. Pretty huge.
Well, this dovetails nicely into what I've been working on the past few days here.
Well, I was wondering if you're going to dovetail nicely into what you've been working on.
I was going to. There you go. Well, you're talking about AM and maintenance and savings, and I've been spending the past few days working on my AM array, which you've seen in Hale's Corners. There, we have five towers. It's a five-tower directional array. Four of them at night are online. Two of them are online during the day. And, you know, like everywhere else, we have issues with lightning. And especially in the Midwest, we get some pretty good lightning storms. And I would say a good 90% of the time, everything's just fine. It's that 10% of the time we really get whacked. And we end up losing things, you know, transmitters shut down, or, you know, it's mostly transmitters and things like that, which all kind of points back to lightning grounding and redundancy and those sorts of things. So the first project we've been working on is redoing the lightning grounding at the towers and adjusting the spark gaps. We also put in new copper ground rods along with copper strap leading to the tower bases to the new ground rods. But something real interesting with that is doing the calculations for the gaps. And I think a lot of guys who do AM maintenance would be surprised how close those gaps really need to be. You know, I don't know how many sites I've been to, AM sites where I go and I see, you know, spark gaps, you know, that far apart. And, you know, Nautel has a great white paper along with the calculations on how to figure it out. And we're literally, for my 5 kilowatt AM, talking millimeters in between the ball gaps for the lightning to arc over. For those of you who don't follow, AM towers are isolated from the ground. So when lightning hits them, if you don't have a path to ground, the quickest way for the lightning to go is right into your equipment. So generally
that's really bad when you're $60,000 AM transmitter becomes the most convenient available fuse.
Right. So what you try to do is you try to give the lightning several paths to ground on the way. And the way you do that is in several places you have these smooth kind of chrome balls, essentially, that are very close together with a little gap of air in between, in the hopes that the lightning will jump that to ground. The other side of that ball goes right into the ground through copper. And you use that in the hopes that that's where the lightning goes. So as part of this process, we've gone through and, you know, have re-gapped everything and cleaned them and ran new copper and those sorts of things. But another interesting thing that we've done is my backup transmitter is a 1957 RCA BTA5, which is a great transmitter. But it's old, and we have to rely on that every so often when the brand new Nautel XR6 has a lightning issue. One of the great things that Nautel has done is they designed the transmitter to take two power amplifiers. So you have a power amplifier is a module that has four amplifier blocks to it. Okay. Pretty much all self-containing. All the tuning and everything is in this big drawer, and you slide that in. And that's essentially the heart of the transmitter.
Okay.
They've made provisions for a second drawer, so you can have a backup drawer in there in case the first one fails. This is kind of interesting in terms of how the bean counters in radio look at it. I had to present my case as to why we should get one of these, because typically, like a lot of companies, a tube is considered a consumable. So I had to kind of prove why this wasn't the equivalent of buying a tube for a transmitter.
Speaking of the ball gap, we got a picture of it here. Burke got for us. That's what you're talking about in terms of a ball gap. And this is the one of those balls is at the full RF potential of the tower. It's hot with RF.
Right.
The other ball is at ground potential. It's tied very heavily to the ground. And so you put these things so they're close together. So under normal AM power, there's no arcing that occurs across those balls. But as soon as there's a little bit more voltage on the tower than the normal AM transmitter power, zap, you get an arc across those. And so lightning would travel quite well across that gap. And, you know, hey, hopefully if a lightning bolt is, I don't know, 500,000 volts, and we get 98% of it to go to ground. Well, we still have some left over to deal with the other ways, toward the transmitter. But at least we've gotten rid of 98% of it.
Got rid of most of it. Anyway, back to so in a lot of cases, a tube is considered consumable and therefore not a not something you can capitalize, purchasing capitalize on. Okay. And these drawers are they're not cheap. These drawers are not inexpensive. So I had to make the case and actually made it to our accountants that this was actually essentially a backup transmitter in a box, because that's what it is. The way the transmitter is designed is really the guts of the transmitter are in these drawers. And if you take out the drawer, you essentially have a refrigerator. it's just a dumb box. So they approved it, and I got that put in. So I essentially now have almost two other backups. You know, if for some reason we do have a failure in the main power block, I can switch it to the backup power drawer. If that fails, then I can go back to the RCA transmitter. But what that allows for is with these power drawers, they have individual power amplifiers that can, those are pr- pretty common failures with lightning. You know, I mean, even if, as you said, even if that 98% gets dissipated, sometimes even that 1% makes it all the way back. And usually one of the little modules inside that drawer goes bad. Well, when that's the case, you have to take the drawer out. So we're back on this 1957 transmitter while I replace those parts. Well, now we can be, you know, full power, full modulation on our solid state transmitter on the one drawer, and I can just take the other one out and fix it. But it's all part of a bigger thing with this AM station, going, okay, what are the things we can do to improve the reliability, especially with storm season, with grounding? What can we do with the transmitter to make it more reliable? You know, so we've been going through cleaning the ATUs, putting in, you know, making sure that the spark gaps in the ATUs were good, and just really piece by piece working through the process. And it was kind of funny because I put on Twitter the other day, I've done all this stuff and I can't wait for a lightning storm now to see what happens. Usually engineers dread lightning storms, but I'm looking forward to it, see if it works. You know, if not, I've got to go back to the drawing board. But, you know, I spent several days doing that. But again, you'd be surprised with AM sites, you know, especially, you know, some of the ones that have been kind of ignored, how bad the grounding really is and how neglected that part of it is.
You know, I hear about this thing about grounding deteriorating, and I want to talk about that in just a second. I got a question about the power drawer. In the design of this transmitter, you've got this optional second power drawer that has these four modules, you said. By the way, what power level was this transmitter?
It actually runs at 6 kilowatts. I run it at 5.4. It's a 6 kilowatt transmitter.
Okay. All right. So if is it possible to make these two drawers share the load, so to speak, or is it really one or the other?
No, for isolation, they actually have the drawers separate, because what you don't want is you don't want lightning to come in and take both of them out, you know, when you have both of them on, because then you're really down. So one of them's on, the other one is isolated so that it's protected if anything happens. And then, you know, that way, if something happens to the one drawer, you can then switch it through, you know, to the logic through the relays to the second drawer and put that on the air. But they're identical. So, you know, essentially what happens is it is almost like having a backup transmitter in your back pocket, because really the only thing that's in the cabinet of this transmitter is the exciter and the power supplies. And, you know, those are all that kind of stuff really doesn't have a connection to the tower per se. So they're pretty, you know, I've never had a failure there. But where you do see the common failures are the same on a lot of solid state transmitters, where you have, you know, these transistors blowing and things like that, just from the discharge of lightning, either through EMP or, you know, stray voltage or whatever. And this kind of helps you with that, because, you know, you can switch over and remain on full power while you take this other drawer out. And, you know, the parts to replace them are really inexpensive, but you do have to have the transmitter off for a while you do it. So it's just a good backup plan to have. And not only that, but when you're relying on old 1957 transmitter, which runs great, but you just never know, parts are hard to find for it, and you really don't want to have that go down while you're working on the other one. So it's really, as far as I'm concerned, inexpensive insurance.
A little while ago you mentioned bean counters, and I'm just wondering, that 1957 transmitter, is that fully depreciated yet?
No, actually, I fully appreciate it, actually.
Yeah, no, there you go.
I think it's probably so old that they don't even want it on the asset list at this point.
I bet. Hey, I'm kind of curious, that 57 transmitter, what kind of transmitter is that?
That is an RCA BTA-5.
Wow, a BTA. Cool. So that's a plate-modulated transmitter?
Yeah, it's got four 225s. Are 2250s, and I don't remember what the power tubes are on those, but it's a big old cabinet, glows, sounds phenomenal on the air, by the way. It's all tubes, and just sounds really, really good on the air. People know when I have it on, they'll go, oh, you're running your backup, aren't you? It sounds really good.
Well, does that, now, it doesn't sound better than the Nautel, does it?
I think it does. I mean, you know, it has its own sound. You know, obviously, the Nautel is much louder. The Nautel is capable of, you know, 150% modulation and you know, all these different things. You know, but the RCA has this nice, warm, you know, nice, warm, clean sound to it. In fact, some night, just to test, I'm going to, you know, maybe try running a little more than 10 kilohertz through it to see how it performs. You know, back in those days, those transmitters were flat, almost flat, 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz.
Yeah.
And you know, those old plate modulated rigs, they just the sound of them, they have a certain character to them, and you can't beat it. Chris is right. It's got that nice warm sound to it. Depending on the modulation transformer and how the modulation circuit is designed, you can hear the thing bounce, and they just sound so cool.
They really do. I love turning it on, and you know, about once a month I put it on just to give it some work, and it's really interesting. You can, you know, just like every other tube type transmitter, you can hear it sing as the audio goes through it. You know, the warm glow of the tubes, it's got a really quiet fan to it. It's a neat transmitter. And I know it's kind of the highlight when people take a tour of the facility. That transmitter is kind of a highlight of the tour. I usually put it on and put it in the dummy load so people can see it in action. And yes, there's the XR6. That's the current one. And that is one that has the two power drawers in it. That's the Nautel. And it's amazing when you compare the RCA transmitter, which is about five times the size of that, to the XR6, which is the size of a refrigerator, essentially. You know, how that's gotten, the components have gotten smaller and smaller with solid state.
Isn't that true? And that's true in the FM world, too. My business partner is leasing some radio stations in Greenville, Mississippi, and one of them has an FM transmitter, a whole exciter and power amplifier in a two rack unit high box. It's pretty deep, but it's two rack units tall. It puts out 1,300 watts of FM power, and that includes the exciter inside of it. I think it's an Italian make. I want to say that I think it may be a Bext brand on the front, but I could be wrong. It might be something else. How big a box did it used to take to make 1,300 watts of FM? It was a refrigerator size cabinet.
I remember walking into a site, not FM, but an AM site many years ago. They had a Harris MW1, you know, which is a refrigerator size unit. And they had the original RCA 250 watt transmitter they signed on with. And that thing, oh Lord, you could have driven a large Buick into it. It was unbelievable just for 250 watts, the size.
Oh my goodness. Hey, on the chat room here, Chris, the BTA5 uses 892R tubes in the final RF and AF sections. Does that sound right?
Actually, I have to look it up. I'm sure that's right. I don't recall off the top of my head.
Erica reminds me that Bext are made by RVR, and I'm not sure if that's true for every model that Bext sells. But anyway, it's just amazing to see a 1,300 watts transmitter in about 3.5 inches of vertical rack space and maybe 22 inches deep or so. It sounds like a jet turbine when it runs because it's got some fans blowing air across all the transistors that get so hot.
Wow. I just sent Burke a link to the RCA transmitter that I took a picture of in the facility, so that get that so everyone can see that the actual transmitter they're talking about.
This episode of This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Axia Audio, and they're the makers of the new IQ console. It's now shipping. The long-awaited IQ console is now shipping. It's the standalone console that networks too. Hey, it's got a lot of features that the Element console has, and it connects right up to a live wire network, and that means it's quick and easy to install. Listen, if you haven't installed an Axia console that has a live wire network, you don't know what easy is. You can eliminate so much wiring, so much stripping wires and soldering and all that kind of stuff, and putting in a lot of infrastructure cabling from room to room, multi-conductor cables, except for, you know, Cat5s and Cat6s. Those big multi-conductor cables, that goes away. Hey, I've wired many studios myself with Axia LiveWire audio over IP, and I'll tell you, it's just so easy. I have a radio station of my own in Cleveland, Mississippi, that I wired, honest to goodness, the control room and the rack room, put these things together in 3.5 hours. It's a real radio station. Yeah, it's a small station, but we have a morning show. We do production all day long, and I've got a small Element console. Well, hey, now the IQ console is shipping. You want to know some of the features in the IQ console? It sounds like a big console, and yet it's under $8,000 for the IQ console at the U.S. list price. It has three stereo program buses and a dedicated utility bus to use for phones, off-air recording, or as a fourth program bus. A record mode, one-touch off-air recording. Automatic per fader mix minus. That's right. Every fader has its own automatic
Mix Minus. An event time with auto start and auto reset. There's a studio and control room monitor controls. Well, of course you expect control room, but it's got a studio monitor control too. That means you can use the IQ to control a different studio, like a talk studio. It has 4 show profile snapshots to save and recall commonly used configurations. It has an easy talkback system. You can talk back to any source coming into the console if it's got a path going back to it, like a telephone hybrid or a codec, even a satellite feed if you've got an IFB dialed in with your outside reporter dialing in that way. Switchable VU PPM program meters. So, hey, you folks where you want to see PPM meters, you got it. High-resolution OLED information displays. These look really nice. Premium quality 100mm conductive plastic faders. And I'll tell you, these faders are cool because if you spill something on this console, chances are that liquid will not go into the fader. The faders are not open to the top. They're open on the side. These are really cool. Expandable via 3 different IQ expansion frame options. There's a telco expansion, 6 faders, plus a 6-line call controller. Yeah, there's a user keyboard expansion. That's 6 more faders with 10 programmable user keys. And there's an 8 fader expansion with 8 additional faders. Hey, you can build this thing. You can add to an IQ console and have up to 24 faders for under $12,000 US suggested list price. There's also a fanless power supply. This thing is cool. It goes in the rack, okay, somewhere near the console, and this power supply has got all the audio I/O. It has a built-in Ethernet switch in it. It's got the connection, of course, to the console, the GPIO ports, the mic inputs. It also, though, is fanless, and the front of it is this very stylish heatsink. It is so cool looking. If you haven't seen it, go to axiaaudio.com and click on the link for the IQ console. It's got 4 mic inputs, 16 analog stereo inputs, 8 analog stereo outputs. By the way, these analog ins and outs, they have 24-bit, 256 times oversampling AD converters. Plus, there are 2 AES-EBU inputs and outputs, and 8 GPIO logic ports. Each one has 5 inputs and 5 outputs. Plus, there's 2 gigabit Ethernet ports, in addition to the, I forget if it's 6 or 8 10-100 Ethernet ports on the back. The switch is built in. You don't have to configure it. We configured it for you at Axia. Plus, there's an optional Telos IQ6 phone system that connects 6 POTS lines or ISDN BRI phone lines via a single Cat5 cable. You got an instant talk show system here with an IQ console. It's really easy, and it is just gorgeous. Check it out on the web. Shipping now. If you're going to the NAB show, come by the Telos booth and check it out. Go to the website, axiaaudio.com, and you will see all about it. I promise you, you're going to like it. I've been showing this console for about a year now at in various venues around the world, and it is just absolutely gorgeous, and I am delighted that it is now shipping. All right, now, on with the show.
The tech, yeah, we've talked about this a little bit on the show before. The tech of an older AM transmitter and a much newer AM transmitter. We touched a moment ago on this idea of plate modulation, and that's basically where we have an audio amplifier that is really high power, and this audio amplifier, I'll simplify it as much as possible, ends up being the thing that provides a boost or a buck voltage to the plate supply of the tubes that are amplifying the RF, that is the radio frequency signal. So there's tubes that are amplifying the radio frequency signal. Let's say you're a station on, 1110, that'd be WBT in Charlotte, on 1110. And so you've got tubes amplifying 1110 kilohertz or 1.11 megahertz. And if we were to add voltage available to them in the amplification process and take away voltage available to them in the amplification process, and that voltage variation was at the rate of the audio, well, then we have amplitude modulation. We've amplitude modulated the RF carrier, and that's essentially how a plate modulated transmitter works. We add power and take away power available to the circuit that amplifies the RF, and we do that at the rate of the audio, and we get all that power to do that by the audio amplifier. There are other ways to make an AM modulated signal, and one of those that's really commonly used, both in some tube designs and now in solid-state designs, is essentially a pulse width or a pulse duration modulation design. where we we're kind of doing the same thing. We're amplifying what's available to the output transistors, but we're doing it with solid state devices, and we're doing it in a way that's actually digital in that it's on off, and that can be very efficient for an amplifier to do. If all a transistor has to do is turn on, turn off, that can be very efficient. But if a transistor has to amplify varying amounts, as with a Class A amplifier or even a Class AB amplifier, then you get a lot less efficiency. So, two other methods of modulation with high power transmitters. One was a Doherty design, which you guys correct me if I really go astray here. In a Doherty design, you've got two big power tubes. One of them basically puts out the carrier power, and the other one is coupled to it in such a way that it turns on and adds power to the signal during peaks of positive modulation. So the carrier, and
they're actually coupled 90 degrees out of phase with each other. So technically, they don't see each other. Is kind of the secret to the tuning on the thing.
Right. Exactly. So and then the other method of modulation that I'm thinking of is what? Oh yeah, the ampliphase method. That RCA built a bunch of transmitters that do that. Where we have to come up with 10 kilowatts of AM power, don't you have basically two 10 kilowatt amplifiers? And they are the thing is, the phase between their signals is varied, and you end up having a combiner between these two amplifiers. Then there's an output that goes to the antenna, and then there's another output that goes to the reject load or the dummy load. And this is a very, talk about non-green, this is a very inefficient design, because it's always throwing away power in the form of heat, but it's making very clean power because the components don't have to vary their power level. Each transmitter operates at a consistent power level, and what's varied is the phase between them. So when you combine them, they either combine constructively or destructively, depending on exactly where that phase is, and the output signal can be just darn near perfect. Did I get that right?
I've never had one. I don't know.
Yeah, we've discussed it before. That sounds about right, from what I remember with those transmitters. The other Chris is an expert on ampliphase. He had a couple of them, I guess.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Because
that's the way he described it, if I remember right.
Yeah, they were usually some big, in small power sizes, didn't make as much sense. But RCA was building them for 50 kilowatt and 10 kilowatt and a few 5 kilowatt.
There's my RCA transmitter there. That's a picture.
Oh, okay. Tell us about that one. What, that hails from 1957?
Yeah, that's the 1957. It actually still has the Conelrad crystals installed.
Conelrad crystals.
Conelrad was the precursor to, well, actually, now we have EAS. Before that was EBS, the Emergency Broadcast System. And before that was Conelrad. And where Conelrad was essentially, they figured if there was any kind of incoming bombers, that they would try to find frequencies to lock onto to determine where the bombing was going to be, certain frequencies in certain cities, and they'd use radios to, the new frequency. So the purpose of Conelrad was to take all of the AM stations that participated. If you didn't participate, you shut down. If you did, you went on one of two assigned frequencies. It was 1240 and 6-something, I believe.
It was 640 and 1240, I think.
640 and 1240, yep. That's not right. And so what you do is you'd have, in this particular model of RCA, what they did, it was actually kind of clever. They had a separate tuning network that you could have installed, and you could switch. Obviously, we were at 1250, so we didn't really need it for 1240. But I have worked on these similar transmitters in other markets where they have actually have a second tuning network for that second frequency for Conelrad. But essentially, sure, if the time ever came, you were required to shut down your transmitter, switch frequencies to one of these 1240 or 640, and turn back on. And the purpose was, all across the country, there would only be two frequencies in use, 1240 and 640. So it would be very difficult to lock on and do any kind of damage. That was the theory behind it. So anyway, this transmitter still has those provisions. This also had another thing you'll see a lot of put in aftermarket on these through RCA is the power control for stations that power down at night. So you could have a 5,000-watt setting and a 1,000-watt setting. So that had that on there as well. But the transmitter, in fact, just recently I went through and cleaned it all out, and very few modifications to it. There are a few, but very little in the way of changes or modifications to it. Still runs fantastic. We still have a lot of still a lot of hours on it, and gives us good service. It's just that, unfortunately, due to the design, if something fails, it's very hard to find parts for it. So we try to use it as sparingly as possible. But it sounds great and works really, really well. And it's a sight to see when you turn it on and all the tubes start glowing behind that glass, and you hear the programming through the coils and things. It's pretty neat.
Does it still have the mercury vapor rectifiers, or does it have solid state rectifiers?
That's been converted to solid state. Yeah, that is one of the ones that was done.
I loved it. The first station I ever engineered at was a little AM in Berea, Kentucky, WKXO on 1500 AM. And we had a Gates BC250GY transmitter, a transmitter that if you didn't move anything, you could stand inside of it while it was on. Not that you'd want to, but there's room to stand inside of it while it's on. There's high voltage all around you. Well, it had the mercury vapor rectifiers, and for those listening, it was actually, but before they invented solid state devices like diodes, especially diodes big enough to handle the voltage and the current, they had to have some way to take a high voltage AC signal, high voltage AC power supply, and convert that into DC. And the way to do it then was to use a mercury vapor rectifier tube. And these were often pretty tall tubes, at least, even in a small 250-watt transmitter, pretty tall tube. And inside of it was mercury, and you had to let them warm up to vaporize the mercury so you have a cloud of mercury inside this tube. Heaven help you if you break the tube and get mercury on yourself. I guess they didn't know it was dangerous then. And so they take this AC current and apply it to the tube, and it would only pass one way, for the most part, and so you'd end up getting a reasonable DC power out of the circuit.
I like that. It would pass one way for the most part. That was the fault with these things.
Well, it was never a perfect rectifier. There's a little bit of leakage current in the backward direction. I ended up replacing my mercury vapor rectifiers with then the solid state replacements, which, what I want to point out, though, is these mercury vapor rectifiers, they would glow purple. There you go. There's a thank you, Burke. You're right on the spot. Mercury vapor. Now those are smaller ones than what we had. The ones we had were bigger than what was Burke was just showing there. I'm sorry, Tom. You go right ahead.
No, I was going to say I said they had glowed that nice purple, and actually, I just came up with another picture here. I'll send it over to Burke. These are probably more of what you had in the transmitter. These are a bigger version of the tube.
From the chat room, Nerdful Things says the first subway power that needed DC used huge mercury vapor tubes. That would be. I'm sure there's plenty of other industries besides ours that used them. There you go, man. You talk about science fiction. I mean, that mercury vapor. I think mercury vapor tubes were cooler than the normal tubes that we dealt with. The ones that were typically at eye level in a transfer that you would see. So, how many of you have run through an AM transmitter that has tubes? Run a 10 kilohertz tone and just see what the tubes do.
Oh, they glow real nice. especially at 100% modulation. The plates, if you've got glass tubes in there, the plates sometimes get a nice, pretty red.
Sometimes we would stress, like, remember the 833A tubes? These were the ones they had, two nipples on the top, two nipples on the bottom. So it was just a triode tube, filament on the bottom, grid and plate. And the plate was this big flat thing folded over, right? So it had a front and back, but the high voltage was on this plate inside. And the way the tube ended up working is there would be this cherry red dot in the middle of the plate. So this metal would actually turn red when the tube was, sometimes being pushed too hard, but under normal operation, it'd be a little bit red there. You turn out the lights and you'd see this red glow. And boy, you apply a high frequency tone and crank up the modulation. And man, you just thought, I don't know how the glass envelope didn't end up exploding with, as red as these things got. And the more powerful audio processors that we got. Now, again, this was back in, I'm talking 50s, 1960s, 1970s, early 1980s. There you go. There's another picture of a mercury vapor tube. And is that a getter out to the front right of the tube structure there? Does anybody know what a getter is?
Looks like to me.
Yeah. Tom, can you explain so many tubes, even if you go find an old TV set or an old guitar amplifier that uses like 6L6GC tubes, oftentimes you'll see on the inside of the glass envelope, you'll see this silverized spot. And if you look behind that silverized spot, you'll see a metal stick, often with a metal loop on it. And that was called the getter. Tom, do you know what the getter did?
You know, I'm really not sure. I mean, I've seen the getter. I know what it is to look at it. And as a matter of fact, I'm looking right now online to see if we can figure out exactly what it does. But I think it's something that helps the electron flow, if I'm not mistaken. I just don't know how. I've never had to get involved with one, really.
And some tubes actually had these at the top of the tube. In fact, a lot of small tubes like radio and TV tubes, the getter was at the top. Remember how the top of the tube was kind of silverized?
The one I'm looking at online right now looks kind of like an angel's halo.
Yeah. So a getter, that's a deposit of reactive material that's deliberately placed inside a vacuum tube for completing and maintaining the vacuum. Because when the gas molecules strike the getter material, they combine with it chemically or by absorption, and thus the getter removes tiny amounts of gas from the evacuated space inside the tube. And yes, I'm reading from Wikipedia.
Interesting.
If it sounds like I'm reading, I sure am. But yeah, I knew it has something to do with, you know, getting material out of the inside of the tube. Never knew how it worked. So I'll tell you, Wikipedia is your friend. Hey,
but you know, there was one thing I was going to mention to Chris before. Yeah. When I worked at WTIC in Hartford, we were at 1080, but of course we had been assigned the 640 frequency for Conelrad, and we had an old Gates BC5P2. And Burke, that was the first thing I gave you there, the jhawkins.com. And this transmitter here, we actually had a set. We were on 1080, so we had to have a separate tuning unit. This actually had a separate tuning cabinet on it, which was upstairs. It had been disconnected previously, but it's this was a really cool transmitter. And the interesting thing was, while it was air cooled, and it used 3 CX2500s in the final and the modulator stages, it had a lot of tubes in it. The back doors in the thing acted like a heat sink. And gosh almighty, I remember walking in there one July, we were having towers painted, and this was our ultimate backup transmitter. And we would put it on the air whenever we were having work done to the 50-kilowatt array. And I walked behind the transmitter, and there was a thermometer back there. It was 120 degrees behind that transmitter, and this thing didn't care. It just sat there and ran. Sounded great. Unbelievable.
You know, that's the thing about those old tube rigs and, you know, talking about things like lightning. And I oftentimes, during the lightning storms, will put the RCA on because you could get hit by lightning 100 times. It doesn't care. The solid state stuff is very sensitive to lightning strikes, whereas the RCA just humps right along during a storm. It's amazing.
Chris, that's a great point. Yeah, we've talked a little bit about lightning protection and you know, just even in the show with the lightning ball gaps. By the way, there's other kind of gaps too. The ball gaps are popular for outdoor use. And by the way, you know what's wrong with this picture? You go to an AM tower and for the first time, and you see somebody has installed the ball gaps on the tower, usually the tower company, and they look like this, one above the other. What's wrong with that picture?
Oh, when stuff gets stuck in between those suckers, look out.
Raindrops.
Like raindrops and yeah. Bugs. Well, we've done to actually, I think I brought this up before. My engineer, Madison Pony, has come up with a great solution. And what we do is we take 2-liter soda bottles and cut holes, you know, cut a slit down the center and a hole on the bottom and slip it over the two, over the gap on the two sides and tie wrap it down. And that pretty much keeps all the water and bugs and nastiness out of there. And, you know, every couple of months you just go and change out the bottles and it protects them very well. Because even now, when you actually gap it properly, you're still talking about millimeters. So, you know, water will still get in there and bugs will still get in there and that sort of thing. And we'll cause some issues. But, you know, you see that now more nowadays because, as we're saying, the new modern transmitters are a lot more sensitive to electrical discharge. So back in the day, you could have the gaps spread out quite a bit. And, you know, those old tube rigs had no problem handling that. But, you know, you put in a solid state rig and you don't have that gapped close enough, and you're going to have some issues. So, you know, nowadays it's not uncommon to see a couple of millimeters in between that gap. So you've got to do something to protect it. So yeah, we just use the soda bottles.
You know, it's interesting. At our site, we have, because of all the power around us, we've got you've got us, WR at 50 kilowatts. You've got 1010 Winds right behind us, also at 50 kilowatts, but we're right in the main beam, which is about 160 kilowatts. You've got 1190 at 30 kilowatts. You've got 10 kilowatts at 620 all around the WR site. And, of course, transmitting antennas are wonderful receiving antennas. Our ball gaps are about as far apart as my thumb is wide, because wow. Any closer with all that power, any closer they arc over. It's really, really strange place to set up and work.
Man. Yeah. Cause at a lot of stations that I've worked at, the ball gap could be just a hair thicker than a business card. Yep. And they wouldn't arc over. I may have mentioned this before on the show, but I'll mention it again. Speaking of ball gaps, just down the road from where I am here in Nashville, on the south side of Nashville, is the tower of WSM, which is 50,000 watts at 650 on the AM dial. And their tower is pretty interesting because I don't know if it's closer to a half wave or 5/8 of a wave, but it's a tall AM tower. And I believe that pretty well means that it's got a pretty high voltage at the tower base. The tower base insulators are two things stacked together, two pieces of ceramic, and they're about almost 6 feet tall, I believe. But the ball gap at the bottom of the tower, as I recall, it's set about this far apart. It's been 15 years since I've seen it, but like that. But during the summertime, they lash up a hairdryer out there that's protected from the rain, but it's blowing air through this ball gap all summer long. Of course, I had to ask, why? And the answer is, apparently because gnats, the little flying gnats, are a bit more conductive than air. And apparently this tower site is in a place where gnats tend to, breed and grow and live. And so they kind of hang around there. And when too many of them get between the balls of the ball gap, it arcs over. And
so what you're saying, it's a very expensive bug zapper.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it takes the transmitter off the air briefly while the transmitter realizes, I've got a different impedance now I'm looking at, because now I'm not sending my power nicely to the tower and all tuned up. It's getting shorted somewhere. So my impedance just changed. And so the transmitter clicks off for a second, lets the arc clear out, and then the transmitter starts up again. Well, this happens over and over and over again. They got to figure out, how are we going to keep these gnats away? We could just, widen the ball gap. But that would start to defeat the purpose of having the ball gap in the first place.
So. Right, and that's actually what I find a lot of with AM arrays is, an engineer or a contract guy or whatever gets tired of getting calls for the transmitter tripping, and they just knock the balls apart a little bit farther and to eliminate the calls, and they always seem to go out. They never seem to come back in again. And it's pretty common. And I know it's time to go clean the gaps and put new soda bottles out there when that starts to happen, a nice summer or evening when the mosquitoes come out and all of a sudden I get a call that the transmitter keeps tripping, then we know that we need to clear that out. But, you'd be surprised again, how little it takes, how little of a gap it takes. And Nautel has a great paper, again, I plug it, it has a great paper with all the formulas to calculate, depending on, the voltage to your tower, the dielectric constant of the air changes depending on your altitude, all these different things. And it's several pages long, and you can actually sit there and calculate all these things and come up with the exact spacing for the ball gaps for your tower. It's a great paper.
Chris, if you'll send me the URL for that, I'll make sure it's in the show notes, okay?
Sure.
Okay, awesome. I wanted to mention a couple other. We seem to be on this whole issue of ball gaps and lightning, because this is kind of interesting. I think it's terribly interesting. There's all kinds of lightning protection devices that go on all kinds of different antenna systems. I mean, there are lightning arresters that are made for cellular antennas, or for the feed that comes into a building to a cell site, for example. Broadcasters use lightning arresters for all different kinds of antennas and frequencies of service. Like if you got a 450 megahertz remote pickup system, or a 950 megahertz STL system, or a 160 megahertz RPU system, you're going to have antennas that are exposed to the outdoors that are subject to getting hit by lightning, or lightning could come down the outer conductor of the coax coming in the building, and we need to have ways to, you know, to knock the stuff to ground and to suppress any lightning that's on the center conductor, any high voltage there. So there's all kinds of suppressors available that way. But I think what's terribly interesting are the lightning suppressors that are more visible, more open, that aren't just a closed box that you know have an end connector on each end of it that you run the coax through. And so good practice with a lot of AM stations is that you'll have the ball gaps at the tower. Now, by the way, if you've got a grounded AM tower, which can be the case, you might have a skirt-fed tower, you might have a folded unipole, you might have a slant wire fed tower. There are still some of those around, and even more popular in other places. I've been to the Caribbean where they're, you know, where the slant wire feed is pretty popular. In this case, the tower itself is grounded, and it's being fed at a point where the impedance works out right, whether it's a folded unipole or whether it's a skirt fed, a bazooka feed, you might call it, or a slant wire feed. So the tower's grounded, but you're still going to have, if lightning hits the tower, you're still going to have some feed of some power, some voltage off the whatever is feeding the tower. So what's often done is if there's a tuning house, a tuning box, modern ones would be made out of metal. They should be very well grounded if they're anywhere near the tower, no matter where they are. They should be well grounded to the station's ground system. And inside the tuning house, oftentimes there's what we call a horn gap. And this looks a little bit like the Jacob's ladder thing that you see on Frankenstein movies, right? That, you know, that the spark can crawl up this Jacob's ladder thing. So a horn gap is more substantial than a couple of, you know, coat hanger wires. It's, you know, pretty substantial pieces of metal that come close together and then separate. And the idea is that one side of this is grounded and the other side of this is hot with the AMRF power. So if lightning is going to get into your system, it's got to, first of all, hit the tower, assuming it's a series fed tower, hit the tower, go across the ball gap. Whatever doesn't go across the ball gap may come through. Let's say you have a single turn loop that's feeding the AM tower, comes to your antenna tuning unit, goes through the insulator into the inside of the box, and there hits this horn gap. And I have found these horn gaps to be very effective, particularly because they're dry. In inclement weather, they're inside the tuning house. And so they're typically going to be dry, especially if you have a light bulb in there or it's somehow heated in the wintertime. This thing is dry. It's out of the elements. And so you can set it pretty close too, perhaps closer, probably a lot closer than the outside one. Before the lightning, whatever's left of the lightning is going to get into the components of the tuning house and finally back to your transmitter. You guys ever had any horn gaps?
We've got them at WR, but you didn't mention one of the most common forms of lightning protection at a AM transmitter site.
What's that?
Well, if you take a look, you've got the tower and you've got the tuning house. And, well, this is where the RF is in the tuning house, and here's where the RF's got to go. So you've got to have some way to connect the two together. It's normally a copper pipe.
Right.
And you'll notice that most copper pipes from a between the tuning house and the tower have at least one turn or one squiggle in them.
Yep, exactly.
That's a very large inductor at the pulse rate of a lightning strike.
So
and that will slow it down coming into
and
the...
And oftentimes this is one turn, and hey... How do you, by the way, when you're building one of these, we oftentimes make these, this copper pipe you mentioned. I've used air conditioner copper pipe, you know, it comes in an air conditioning kit to build this piece of pipe between the tuning house and the tower. Mm-hmm. And I've heard of several techniques, but the most common one I hear is fill the copper pipe with sand and then... take this sand-filled copper pipe and wrap it around like a 5-gallon bucket. And because it's filled with sand, it won't buckle. If you buckle it, you've ruined it.
Well, when we built our site, we just went to Home Depot and it comes in a coil.
Oh, okay.
we should need a cheater.
I mentioned the horn gaps. I find with the horn gaps, you see the same thing you find with the spark gaps. Whereas what I'm talking about, where they always seem to get farther apart. They never seem to get closer together. So that was another thing we went to with all the ATUs the past week, is to go out through and make sure that those were gapped too, because invariably somebody moves them apart when they're working on the ATU or something where, you know, there's some arcing issues or troubleshooting. And invariably you just forget to put them back. But you're right. I mean, that's your second line of defense right there. And you want to get, you know, and get those as close as possible as well.
Well, guys, another hour has passed us by, and we've talked about a whole lot of things. Some of it actually worthwhile. Some of it just a lot of shooting the bull. And I have a good time every show that we do this. I hope our listeners learn a few things, or at least it gives them impetus to go look something up that they might not otherwise know. Hey, at the beginning of the show, I said, "Hey, Chris Tarr, it's been a while since we've mentioned your website. Why don't you tell us about the Geek Jedi and tell us what happens there, and what might an engineer enjoy by going to your website?"
Oh, well, the Geek Jedi is actually just my personal site, and that has links to pretty much everything related to me, Twitter, Facebook, all that kind of stuff. The site that you're talking about is the broadcastengineering.info. That's broadcastengineering.info. And what it is, we kind of joke that it's sort of like an SBE meeting on the web. And we have hundreds of visitors, thousands of posts, and it's basically a bunch of radio engineers, TV engineers, or anybody interested in engineering is on there asking questions, helping each other out, talking about different types of gear. It really is a lot of fun. It's a great resource, too. I find I actually ask a lot of my questions there. There's a lot of pretty smart people who hang out there and talk about it. So certainly go on by and register, and we'll get you set up over there. Again, that's broadcastengineering.info.
Cool. Nice. A lot of forums are going on there, and they're labeled, and looks like a welcome place to get your questions answered.
Oh, I like, you know, like I said, a lot of people smarter than me hang out there, so it's really nice.
Well, that's a good thing. Hey, guys, who's going to NAB? Tom, are you able to go this year?
I won't be able to go this year. I got a little too much going on, so I'll be the anchor in New York for your show.
Awesome. Well, we need that. Chris Tarr, any chance of seeing you there?
Nope, I'm going to be here.
All right. Well, I'll be there, and thank goodness the Twit Network is going to be hosting this week in Radio Tech from there. By the way, hi, Burke. Got to go?
Burke's going.
Burke's going. Hey, Burke's going. Hey.
All right.
Well, on Wednesday during NAB, that would be, what's the date there? 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, about the 12th or 13th. Whatever the Wednesday is, the week of NAB in April. Our show is going to have a serious time shift. We won't be doing the show live in the evening because they won't let us broadcast from the NAB floor after about 4 p.m. So we're going to be doing the show in the morning at about noon Eastern time, 11 Central, and 9 a.m. Pacific time. So it'll be first thing in the morning for us on the West Coast on Wednesday. So join us for This Week in Radio Tech. That's 2 weeks from right now. Next week we'll be here, same time, same station, same bat channel. Hey, thanks, guys. We got to run. We're over time, and thanks for listening. If you want to download our podcast, easy to do. Subscribe in the iTunes store. That's really easy. They'll get downloaded automatically every week to your hard drive, to your i device, and you can listen to it at your leisure. You can also friend us on Facebook. Appreciate it if you would. You'll get updates on when the newest shows are posted and a little brief description of them, and you can even listen from our webpage on Facebook. So just check out, search for Twert. You'll find us there, no problem. The main website is thisweekinradiotech.com. You can also listen to the show there. And if you go to that website, you can post show notes right there. If there's something you'd like to add about each show, just add a comment on that show, and it'll appear, you know, right there. And we'd appreciate your participation. Thanks for listening. I appreciate you very much. Bert, thank you now. And we'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
This episode of This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you exclusively by Axia Audio and the new, now shipping, IQ Audio Console. Check it on the web at axiaaudio.com.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes Store.
Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny Lopez Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.